Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Back to the power struggle in Egypt. What does it look like on the streets of Cairo and other cities? Well, certainly nothing like the heroic embrace of democracy that the now cynical term Arab Spring tried to describe more than 2 years ago. Today has been declared a day of rage by the besieged Muslim Brothers. Defiant and now bloody protests have broken out just 2 days after hundreds died in the worst civil unrest in Egypt's modern history. BBC reporter Hugh Sykes filed these impressions of a city immersed in fear of what's to come.
There's a very uncomfortable atmosphere here in Cairo today. There's still traffic on the streets and people walking around, and a few shops are open. Prayers are coming to an end now. And in the middle of this crossroads, there's a white taxi with its windscreen completely smashed in, abandoned by the driver. Walking along in the shade here in central Cairo, I've just been into an off-license. It's shelves stacked from floor to ceiling with bottles of spirits, whiskey, arak, and wine, and the local beer, Stella Lager beer. None of the men behind the counter or the man at the till wanted to speak to me on the record, but the man behind the till said, Ikhwan Harra, which means, loosely translated, Ikhwan, well, that's the brotherhood, are ungodly. What's happened here, just round the corner from the cafe where I was having my coffee, a large column of Muslim Brothers supporters, about 500 people I would guess, marching slowly along behind a banner with an image of former President Mohamed Morsi, or as they would say, President Mohamed Morsi. A peaceful march, determined men wheeling right now out of this main street down one of the side streets, which will lead them eventually towards Ramses Square, which is one of the main focuses, destinations of today's protest.
Hugh Sykes filed that dispatch from Cairo shortly after today's Friday noon prayers. Is this the beginning of a protracted conflict or the last scenes of the latest episode of confrontation between forces that have battled on and off in Egypt for more than 60 years, the Egyptian military and the Islamist Muslim Brothers? We'll end this hour by exploring that question with Hugh Roberts, a professor of North African and Middle Eastern history at Tufts University and the former director of the International Crisis Group's North Africa Project. Roberts says a disturbing model of what the Egyptian military seems to be trying to do right now can be found to the west in Algeria, where military and elected Islamist forces have faced off for decades.
There is clearly a parallel between what the Egyptian army is now doing and what the Algerian army set out to do 21 years ago in the beginning of the drama in Algeria, the decision to end or disrupt or mount a coup against a constitutional political process that involved a legalized Islamist party participating in elections and winning them. So there's that parallel, and it does look as if the Egyptian army is intent on eradicating, to use a term borrowed from the Algerian context, the Islamists who are resisting them. So there is a parallel. Egypt, of course, is a different country.
Well, if the Algerian model does hold here, we're 21 years away from getting our heads above water in terms of a positive a headline in Cairo. What is it about Egypt that would mitigate against that 21 years, and what are the positive signs that you can see?
I don't see positive signs at the moment at all. I see an infernal, implacable logic of confrontation and violence. The main difference between the two cases is there's no tradition of rural guerrilla warfare in Egypt, which was it's a central tradition in Algeria. It's the tradition of the Algerian Revolution. So the prospect of widespread guerrilla activity in the Algerian style is not really there in Egypt. But what is certainly on the cards is continued violence in the cities and recourse to terrorism and bitter sectarian conflict, which we're already seeing beginning with attacks on Coptic churches and so on. the signs are at the moment that the military in Egypt are not interested in a deal, are not interested in reconciliation. They seem to be playing double or quits and forcing the brothers to take a similar attitude. So the signs of today are that this is going to go on and get worse.
If we're going to look at U.S. policy in regards to its impact on what happens in Egypt, it seems to me that if U.S. aid is maintained, whatever American notions of being an interlocutor or a mediator between the two sides really has to confront the fact that most of that aid goes to help the military and basically bolster the forces that are pushing for eradication here, yes?
Yes, I think that a lot of people are massively overestimating the degree of influence that aid actually gives Washington. The aid is tied, in a sense. It's really a subsidy to the Egyptian army to buy its arms and equipment from American manufacturers. So it's a way of guaranteeing those manufacturers a market in Egypt. That doesn't really buy much more, other than perhaps continued willingness to maintain good relations with Israel. The idea that this buys Washington a right to say what should happen in internal politics, I think, is an illusion. And we're seeing at the moment that it's an illusion. Cairo, the military, are not taking any notice of the rhetoric of Western political leaders.
But what would you say to the op-ed in the New York Times today of Amr Darag, who's of Mohamed Morsi, the ousted president's party, suggesting that it was Morsi who learned of his own demise from the United States and that the United States is working closely, at least in his view, with the generals in power right now?
Well, the stark fact is that what is clearly a coup has not been called a coup by Washington. And I think that this is something that speaks volumes in a way. The unwillingness of this administration to call a self-evident coup a coup is something that ensures that it will have no influence in the short and medium term. Clearly, to call it a coup would have been to at least suspend the aid arrangement, but that could have made an impression on the Egyptian military. The refusal to do that means that the Egyptian military has nothing much to worry about.
Well, then that leads to the last question here, and that is, you know, we've got 21 years in Algeria of really bloody stalemate moving towards a positive sort of outcome, and we're still not there yet. Lebanon had a civil war that went on for decades. The Syrian situation has no sign of change. Any sense of a clock ticking here in Egypt?
Well, we're at the beginning of a dreadful drama in Egypt, and I think we're looking at a situation where the army is set on following through on what it has started. Given that it has backing from the Gulf states where the financial position is concerned, at least for the coming year, we're in a situation where the players are leaving no room for maneuver for themselves or their adversaries. It's a confrontation. And it looks as if the outside world can't stop it.
Hugh Roberts is the Edward Keller Professor of North African and Middle Eastern History at Tufts University and the former director of the International Crisis Group's North Africa Project. We're looking for your view on the deteriorating situation in Egypt. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in. And next week, we'll be examining the consequences of the Supreme Court's decision to strike down key provisions of the Voting Rights Act in states like North Carolina, Florida, and Texas.
It was clear then and remains clear now that the resistance to voting rights for African Americans and other minority groups is stronger and remains stronger in those states that were originally covered by the preclearance provision.
A national guided tour of changes in the Voting Rights Act. As always, we want to hear your stories from where you are. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.